Doug Chang, who is an excellent student at Stony Brook. He's a PhD student. And Ruben Essig, who also turns out to be Jay's advisor. And Chris Kuvaris, who is based in Denmark. And this also has a pointer, right? Oh, but it's really small. Okay, that's okay.
There's also a stick if you want.
Yeah, I'm an old-fashioned person.
Around the corner?
Around the corner stick. Oh, it's actually a hockey stick.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, this is useful. Okay, so today's talk is a talk about particle dark matter, but it's a bit unconventional. And I want to invite you to put ourselves in a pessimistic scenario, which is however likely, okay? And the pessimistic scenario that I want to consider in this talk is that it may be the case that dark matter doesn't have any detectable non-gravitational interactions with the standard model. And if this is the case, this is, of course, a disaster for the program of particle dark matter physics, because all the fantastic experiments that we have in underground laboratories and accelerators, they will fail to tell us anything about dark matter. The only thing that they will tell us is that dark matter is invisible to us, at least non-gravitationally. And then we will be in a very tough spot. So the question that I want to try to answer is that if we are in this...
Lensing,
right? Huh? That's Lensing. No, it's not Lensing. This is actually a Chinese artist. He paints himself and just like hides in places.
Wow.
He did it the first time to protest about some buildings that they did for the Olympics in his hometown in China. He just painted himself to say, see, that people is not important. So he just hid like in this way. So not important for the world. Anyways, so that's his name. Anyways. In this scenario, then the question that I want to try to address is, can we learn anything about the nature of particle dark matter if it only interacts with us gravitationally? And fortunately, the answer is yes, because after all, most of what we know about dark matter comes entirely out of cosmological observations, which rely uniquely on the gravitational interactions of dark matter with us. For instance, we know from observations on large scales that dark matter behaves roughly as a cold and collisionless fluid. And the hope is that maybe by studying how dark matter behaves on small scales, we could be able to learn something about its nature. For instance, baryons and CDM, on very large scales, on the largest scales, basically behave in the same way. And it's in small scales, like in subgalactic scales, when we see that baryons start doing all these funny things that baryons do, like forming galaxies and stars within galaxies. So then, in particular, in this talk, I'm going to concentrate about astrophysical signatures of dark matter on small scales. And the reason why I'm doing that is that now it's a good time to be thinking about this, because we have all these new fantastic high-precision observatories that are coming online, such as LSST, Gaia, and LIGO, that they are precisely going to test the behavior of dark matter on small scales. So then...
How do you know that dark matter is made of particles?
We do not know. But I'm a particle theorist, and I'm going to try to motivate models of particle dark matter in which we can learn something from their particle nature based on their gravitational interactions. But we don't know. We do not know. So then the question that I want to try to answer today is there any way in which we can turn this fantastic program in high-precision astronomy into a useful program for particle theory so that we can learn something about the nature of dark matter? And in order for that to happen, what we will need is that dark matter should be some particle that somehow forms astronomical structure that can be observed in any of these observatories. And there are many ways in which dark matter can form interesting structure on subgalactic scales. One of the stories, for instance, is the most popular one, is the story about the primordial black holes. Primordial black holes form interesting structure on small scales in a very specific way. However, there's one way in nature in which astronomical structure is formed, which is preferred. And it's preferred because it was actually realized in nature. In fact, in nature, we have a theory of matter that did form extremely interesting astrophysical structure on small scales. And that example is, of course, the standard model. And the standard model forms astronomical structure following a very specific set of steps. And also, it has two extremely important ingredients that allow for the baryonic sector of the standard model to form galaxies and stars within galaxies. In particular, the standard model forms compact objects because it has two ingredients. First of all, it has strong self-interactions, so baryons can interact with themselves strongly, so they can form hot blobs of gas. And secondly, the standard model is able to cool. And that's crucial for the formation of galaxies and stars within galaxies. And we will see exactly when cooling comes into play in the formation of these objects. In principle, in the standard model, the properties of the astronomical objects that it forms, they can be calculated starting from the standard model Lagrangian. For instance, let me give you a simple example. The standard model in the baryonic sector, there are, of course, white dwarfs. There are stars supported by fermion degeneracy pressure. And there's a theoretical limit on the maximal mass that a white dwarf can have. That's called the Chandrasekhar mass. And that's inversely proportional to the mass of the proton squared. So we immediately see there that that's already information about the Lagrangian of the standard model. So in principle, it seems that it's possible to obtain a map between astrophysical properties of big objects and the Lagrangian parameters of an underlying particle theory. So then, in principle, there's a hope that if dark matter did something similar, we could be able to disentangle what are its particle properties if we have precise enough information of the astrophysical objects that dark matter could form. So while in principle this seems like a decent idea, in practice it's really hard to make concrete. And the reason is that at least we know from the example of the standard model that in the standard model, the formation of galaxies and stars within galaxies is an extremely complicated process. And one of the things that makes it complicated is that the standard model itself is a complicated particle theory. For instance, the standard model has complicated chemistry. The standard model has complicated cooling functions. So for instance, this is the cooling function of the standard model gas as a function of the temperature of the gas. And we see that it has all these funny nonlinear features. And the reason why it has all these funny nonlinear features is that the cooling function in the standard model is not just because of one process, but there are many processes that go into the cooling function. So there's Bremsstrahlung, there's collisional excitation of atoms. So atoms get excited, then they get de-excited, they emit photons, then they cool. There's ionization, recombination. All of this depends on the metallicity of the baryonic gas. All of this depends on the ionization fraction of the baryonic gas. This is for different values of metallicity. Yep. So at C equals zero, it's not that complicated, but it's still complicated. It has like all these funny features here. But okay, there are other complications yet in the standard model. And okay, so it's a complicated problem in general. Not always, but in general, it's a complicated problem. And then the question is, how can we actually get anything calculable if we have all these complications? And as particle theorists, we are used to face complicated problems from the calculational perspective. And usually the ways that we face these problems is that we simplify the problem down to a point to which calculations can start being made. Okay,
so people have thought about this stuff, right, in the context of mirror math.
Exactly.
And just with probably slightly different parameters.
Yeah. So I'm going to comment about that, and yeah, that's an interesting point. And the problematic with those kind of models is that when you actually read the papers, then they are not that predictive. So they can just get one benchmark point, etc. So you will see the difference with our model, hopefully. Okay? But that's a good point. So what we're going to do in this talk then is we're going to simplify the situation to this simplest possible particle model. So what we're going to do is we're going to discuss the complete history of structure formation of probably the simplest dissipative dark sector model that one can think of. Okay, so let me give you a brief outline of what we're going to do. First, I'm just going to introduce what's the model for you so that you get familiar with the kind of particle physics that I have in mind. Secondly, we'll start with the primordial power spectrum, and we will discuss the initial linear evolutions of the perturbations in this dark sector gas. We will see how these perturbations slowly grow. And then finally, they become nonlinear. Once they become nonlinear, so the electron gas or the dark sector gas becomes very dense, they finally form galaxies, and they form interesting substructure within the galaxies. And they finally will form also exotic compact objects. And then after that, I will conclude with some final remarks. And also, I will very briefly discuss how could you detect these compact objects. So let's start with the beginning. So let's try to figure out what's the simplest model of dissipative dark sector that could form interesting structure on a subgalactic scale. So the standard model is a very complicated Lego. Our thing is just a simplified model. Okay? So the model that I have in mind is extremely simple. This is the simplest thing that I could come up with. So it's a model with only two fields. It has a dark electron field, and it has a dark photon field. And the model is so simple that it has only three parameters: a dark electron mass here, a dark photon mass here, and a fine structure constant. And that's it. So it's an extremely simple model. So what we're going to do next, I'm just going to tell you First, we're going to discuss what are the cosmological abundances of the particles in this model. So we have a dark electron, a dark positron, and a dark photon. And then we're going to discuss a bit about the thermodynamics of this model. This will be a bit boring, but it's important for what comes next. And then we will go into the formation of structure in the linear regime. Okay? So first of all, let's discuss about the abundances. So what I have in mind is that the matter sector is composed out of all of these components here. So we have baryons. I will allow also for a large component of cold dark matter. In principle, we have dark photons. They can also be matter because they have a mass. Then we have an abundance of electrons and positrons. In the abundance of electrons and positrons, I'm just going to divide in what's called an asymmetric abundance, which is just the abundance of the dark electrons, and an asymmetric abundance, which is all the rest. So it's the dark positrons and whatever is left of the dark electrons. Okay? So the first thing that I'm going to impose is that the dark sector is asymmetric. So this is in analogy with the standard model. In the standard model, the baryons are also an asymmetric sector. And why am I doing this? I'm doing that because imagine that you had dark electrons and dark positrons within a galaxy. Then they will just quickly annihilate, and the galaxy will evaporate, or also if you have an exotic compact object made of this object. So it will evaporate, and that's of course not nice. So I'm going to impose that this dark sector is asymmetric, so that there are no annihilations between dark electrons and dark positrons within like a galaxy, because we only have dark electrons. And secondly, this is simple because it avoids the complications of bound states. So there are no bound states between positrons and dark electrons. Okay? Imposing that the dark sector is asymmetric is not enough to get rid of all the dark positrons, because you have to make sure that the dark positrons efficiently annihilated with the dark electrons, which are a majority in the early universe. And that process is, of course, just controlled by the fine structure constant. So efficiently depleting the dark positron abundance sets a bound on the minimal value for the fine structure constant. And you see that this constraint is not particularly strong if the fine structure constant is larger than 10 to the minus 7 for the typical model parameters that we're going to take, it's fine. So in this way, we just get rid of the dark electron asymmetry, and now let's discuss the dark photon asymmetry. So dark photons in our model are the things that are going to allow for my matter to cool, so for my dark electrons to cool. And that means that they are generically lightish because they are just carriers of energy. And if they are lightish, they are generically hot relics. So say they decouple when they are non-relativistic, and then their matter density is just fixed by the temperature of this dark sector to the third power. If this temperature is too big, then dark photons will overclose the universe, so that's a problem. Or if this temperature is too big and these dark photons are relativistic at BEBN, that's also a problem because they lead to a contribution to delta ineffective. So in order to avoid problems with overclosure or with delta ineffective, I'm going to require that the dark sector temperature needs to be a factor of a few less than the standard model temperature. So if I do that, then I'm sure that we have no problems with delta ineffective nor overclosure. And in practice, what I will do is to take this temperature to be roughly an order of magnitude less than the standard model temperature. In that case, this abundance is actually negligible, and we can just like forget about also structure formation in the dark photon sector, which may also happen. So that's a tension simplification.
Very natural, right? If you take this dark sector to contain a few species and have a UV contact between the two sectors higher up.
You mean dark photon, dark electrons, or
no,
with the standard model?
With the standard model, if you have a contact in the far UV, then you naturally would expect the temperatures to be a factor of a few lower.
Yeah, system. Right. So then the abundances are very simple. We only have baryons. Then cold dark matter, which will be the majority of dark matter in our model, and an asymmetric dark electron sector, which is just dark electrons. Finally, I'm going to require this asymmetric dark electron sector to be only a subdominant fraction of the whole matter content. And the reason why I need this is that this asymmetric sector needs to have strong self-interactions, and there are mounts on that from the bullet cluster and from halo shapes, so I need to impose this to avoid any problems with self-interacting dark matter.
Simple question. The object has temperature. Radiates. You're claiming this thing, this dark star has a luminosity. It's radiating something. So why don't we see it?
I will go to that, but first of all, these dark photons, remember that they are dark. They are not the photons. So they are dark. They are not our photons. They are just photons in a dark sector, which do not have any electromagnetic interactions with our sector.
Black body radiates. So you're saying it only radiates these dark photons.
Yep.
That's very standard.
Yeah, that's...
If it doesn't couple to our photons, it doesn't radiate photons.
Yeah.
It's a black body or whatever in dark photons, because that's the only photons it couples to. If there's no particle level, if there's no terminal Lagrangian that connects our photons to those things, it won't radiate. It's completely standard. Sorry, it's standard in this sort of hidden sector world.
Sure. Once you find the hidden sector.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. The room doesn't radiate neutrinos. That's a good point. Exactly.
So if we are in this simplified scenario, then it turns out that the thermodynamics is quite simple, not completely simple, but quite simple, and it's governed only by three processes. First of all, we have electron-electron scattering mediated by the dark force, electron-dark photon scattering, that's Compton scattering, and then we have cooling, and this is important. So we have electron-electron scattering, you can emit a photon, that's Bremsstrahlung cooling, so that will be the only important source of cooling actually in our model. So before going to the to structure formation, let's quickly discuss the thermodynamics of this model. So this model is simple, but still has three thermodynamic regimes. So this is a plot of the three thermodynamic regimes at matter radiation equality for the primordial gas. Okay? So this is plotted against the dark electron mass and the dark photon mass for a fixed fine structure constant and fixed asymmetric the fraction. Okay? So first of all, at low electron densities, Compton scattering is very efficient. Electrons and photons can scatter very efficiently. So they are tightly coupled, and they are a unique a tightly coupled Kumovian gas. This also happens in the standard model. Before recombination, in the standard model, electrons and photons are tightly coupled, and they behave as a uniquely Kumovian gas. But if I increase the dark electron mass, in this sector, there's no recombination because there are no bound states. However, I can still decouple the electrons from the photons if I increase the dark electron mass. In that case, Compton scattering becomes inefficient, but the electrons can still scatter with themselves through the dark photon force. So then there's a thermodynamic regime in which dark electrons are self-interacting, but they do not interact with the dark photons. And finally, you cannot see this very well, but if I increase the photon mass, then the molar scattering between the electrons themselves becomes inefficient, and the dark electrons become collisionless. So they behave just as cold dark matter. So we have all this richness even in this simple sector. Okay? So now we have all the tools to discuss actually structure formation. And for the rest of this talk, the objective will be to discuss how dark electrons can form galaxies and what is the substructure within these galaxies. And for concreteness, we're just going to concentrate on the formation of the dark electron galaxy within our Milky Way. So it's literally a dark electron gas around us that may form exotic compact objects, and they are literally around us. So we're going to start first with the linear growth of the matter over density, starting from the primordial power spectrum. And then we will have to change our analysis into a nonlinear regime once the gas becomes very dense. So let's start with the linear regime. The linear regime is defined as the regime in which the dark electron gas over densities or the background matter density is smaller than 1 or much smaller than 1. Okay? In that case, we can do a simplified linear analysis. So our starting point is the primordial power spectrum. The primordial power spectrum contains the initial small overdensities and underdensities in the dark electron gas and also in the baryonic gas. And the primordial power spectrum that I'm going to take is the simplest one. It's just the Harrison-Saldovich one. It's a scale invariant, a featureless primordial power spectrum, which is the same one that led to the formation of structure in the baryonic sector. So this power spectrum doesn't have anything weird in it, like for the story of primordial black holes that needs nonlinearities in the primordial power spectrum. That's not the case here. Here is just the literally Harrison-Saldovich one. Then we can analyze the evolution of these dark electron perturbations using a linear equation of motion, at least initially. And this is an equation that you don't have to look very closely, but there are two terms that I need you to understand. First, there's a term coming from the Hall expansion that it tends to make the dark electron gas less dense. And then the particle physics goes here in this quantity, which is the speed of sound, which has to do with the particle properties of our model and the densities. So the speed of sound in our dark electron sector has an ideal gas piece, and another piece coming from the dark photon repulsive force.
What do you mean less dense? This term is, you're writing an equation for delta, right?
Yeah, I mean that it dumps the over densities. Yeah. Sorry, that's what I mean. That's the correct statement. Yeah. Sorry, it dumps the over densities.
You should also have extra terms from the ordinary matter, right?
In principle, it should. But just remember that, this is just the evolution of the dark electron over densities. Remember that this sector is secluded for the baryonic sector. So it does have them, but it's just gravitational.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but your equation did fluctuations completely decoupled, like you have fluctuations in there.
But they couple gravitationally,
yep.
Right? Yeah. But your equation didn't have it in there.
That's Roche.
It's there. that rho. That has the complete.
Delta k is different for the this field and for the ordinary.
Yeah.
But you only have one delta k here. So
yeah, it's just the Dirac electrons here.
Okay. But this equation isn't your full equation.
It's not the full equation. The derivative will be common, yeah.
So even for adiabatic, the transfer function is different for the dark whatever and for the ordinary photon baryon fluid. And so therefore delta K is different.
But isn't this equation,
right.
This is
I,
as a
curvature,
or
so could this be as a curvature in dark matter? Could it be an interacting, self-interacting as a curvature?
I mean, you could allow that, but even for adiabatic, there's a different delta for the dark and the,
yep.
for the ordinary. But
so
your equation has that in there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like the actual equation that you solved, right?
So what we're going to solve, actually, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to solve. And what I'm going to solve is even simpler, OK?
This is a standard picture.
Standard picture. Yep.
Delta.
Yep.
There's no difference except postulating this dark electron.
So I'm
otherwise it's the same.
Right. So So we're just going to do one step at a time. Okay, so the important information that I'm just going to extract from that equation of motion is that equation of motion tells you that perturbations will grow if you satisfy a criterion that is called the Jeans criterion, which you're probably familiar with. And let me express it in terms of masses. So the Jeans criterion just tells you that if you pick a scale that is large enough, then there will be enough mass in that scale. And then the perturbations in this dark electron sector will start to grow if the mass of the ball that you're considering is larger than something that's called the Jeans mass. The Jeans mass depends on the gravitational potential that you're falling into that's in there and the speed of sound. That's where the particle physics goes into. Okay? If you satisfy the Jeans criterion, then these overdensities are going to grow linearly with the scale factor after matter radiation equality. So that's the only piece of information that we'll actually need from that linear equation of motion. I just want to make sure that my perturbations in some part of parameter space can grow linearly with the scale factor. So let's do that now in these plots that I have here. Yes, but you have to be careful because in our sector we have a speed of sound that is precise to our sector. It's particular to our sector. So that's what we're going to check now, actually.
The reason that dark matter works for structure growth is cosmology. Because the dark matter particles, cold dark matter, do not couple to photons through the charge.
Here
you have a dark charge.
I will go to
charge couples to the dark photon.
Very good question.
Won't that produce pressure oscillations?
I'm going to tell you that.
What you call the pressure oscillations, dark oscillations.
There are dark acoustic oscillations in this sector.
And so the scale of those oscillations is different than the ordinary. Because there's an extra parameter, the temperature of the dark sector. And so if I make that temperature small, the oscillations.
You suppress dark, yeah.
Yeah, but go on.
Okay. So then these plots here show, unfortunately, you cannot see the colors very well, but I'll tell you what these plots are. But these plots are the regions of parameter space over which you satisfy the Jeans criterion for a perturbation of the size of a galaxy, because we are studying for formation of a galaxy at this point. Okay? So you cannot see this very well. But this plot is at matter radiation equality. This is the dark electron mass, the dark photon mass. And this is a function of the electron mass and dark photon temperature, or dark sector temperature, and electron mass and dark photon mass. Okay? So the first thing that I want you to check in these plots, an approximation, but there's here this dashed line that separates the self-interacting electron gas regime from the tightly coupled electron photon regime. Okay? So if I make the dark electron mass too low, then we are, so in white, we have all the regions of parameter space in which you satisfy the Jeans criterion for a perturbation of the size of the galaxy, of the Milky Way galaxy. And in gray, we have the regions of parameter space. You cannot see the gray very well, but it's around here. We have all the regions of parameter space where the perturbations cannot grow on galactic scales. So you see that generically, when we are in the tightly coupled regime, then perturbations cannot grow. And that, of course, makes sense, because as you are saying, there is radiation pressure. And radiation pressure doesn't allow you for these dark electron perturbations to grow. However, if you pick the dark electron mass to be large enough, then the Compton scattering cross-section between the electrons and photons, it's small. And then these dark electrons become self-interacting. They are not tightly coupled with the gas. And we're in this upper regime here where perturbations can indeed grow. So the first thing that we learn from this is that you don't really actually need recombination or some sort of recombination for perturbations to grow after matter radiation equality. You just need, of course, to decouple the electrons from the photons to avoid radiation pressure. And that's done at high enough electron masses. So there are a couple of interesting things in this plot. First of all, here we have in blue, you cannot see it very well, you have the constraints from N-effective. And you see that if we make the dark photon temperature low enough, then there are no constraints. There are also the constraints from the overclosure, same idea. There's also here the constraints from the fact that we have to efficiently deplete the dark positrons. So if we are, again, low enough temperatures, like in this part of our space, basically dark positrons efficiently annihilate. So we're in a good spot. So we see that generally there are regions of parameter space in which linear perturbations or the growth of the linear perturbations is ensured. So if the growth of the linear perturbations is ensured, at least in parts of parameter space, then these perturbations will grow linearly with the scale factor until they become nonlinear. And at some point, when they become nonlinear, the freefall time, which is the dynamical timescale for a ball of gas to collapse to the center just gravitationally, will become comparable with the Hubble expansion time. When that happens, then this ball decouples from the underlying Hubble flow, and that point is called turnaround. And at turnaround, then we do not have to use linear equations of motion anymore on a background dark electron gas. Instead, we have to think about self-gravitating balls of dark electron gas, which are rather compact. Okay? You can actually estimate the turnaround timescale from the primordial power spectrum. There's a simple equation for that. It just tells you when the primordial power spectrum becomes nonlinear as it evolves in time. That tells you that the turnaround redshift for a typical perturbation of the size of the galaxy is around 2. So that's an estimate of the age of assembly of the dark electron galaxy. Okay? So let's quickly recap what we did. We started with primordial regions of under and over densities. They grew linearly with the scale factor for some regions of parameter space. At some point, these perturbations grew a lot, and they became nonlinear. There was turnaround. And once turnaround happened, then we have self-gravitating balls of gas that they will keep collapsing on their own. And now we have to change our analysis into a nonlinear regime. And this is when things get more interesting and a bit harder. And we have to try to understand how these self-gravitating balls of dark electron gas evolve from now on. So now we go into this nonlinear regime, and we have a big ball of gas that is the size of our galaxy. The over densities are much larger than 1, and we have to change our approach. So usually what people do for the standard model in this regime, people use heavy, like big computers.
So is cooling always negligible at early times in this model?
Yes, because linear growth of perturbation, it only cares about gravity. So cooling is not really that important at that stage.
The
but now
these were always low enough that...
Yep.
Okay.
So it was a purely gravitational thing. Yep. Very good. So the way that people study nonlinear evolution of big balls of gas in the standard model, at least in galaxy formation, is that they use big, big computers. They take a supercomputer and they put the dark electron gas, the standard model gas, and they see how it evolves. But that's not necessarily what we want to do, because what we want to do is to explore very generically across all parameter space in our dark sector to see how features arise in different parts of parameter space. And we cannot make a simulation for each point in parameter space. So we want to get an idea of what things happen in different parts of parameter space and a quick idea with some sort of analytic estimates. Fortunately, there was a time back in the 70s where astronomers didn't have big computers, but they still understood a couple of very important concepts about galaxy formation. The first concept is the concept of a Jeans mass that we already encountered. If you have a ball of gas that is large enough, it satisfies the Jeans criterion, it will collapse. If the gas is too small, then it will not satisfy the Jeans criterion, it will not collapse. The Jeans criterion then sets the threshold for collapse or the threshold for realization. The second concept that they understood is the most important one that we're going to be talking for the rest of this talk. It's the concept of fragmentation. And the idea of fragmentation is that the Jeans mass itself, it's a dynamical quantity. So as the halo collapses, the Jeans mass changes. In particular, as the dark electron halo is collapsing, then the Jeans mass can increase or decrease. If it decreases, then that means that small balls within the big halo can start collapsing on their own. That process is called fragmentation, and fragmentation keeps going on. In the standard model, at some point it stops. When it stops, it tells you the minimal size of a big ball of gas that that will collapse, and that's nothing else than a protostar. So that's the origin of the protostars of the standard model, and that will also be the origin of the protostars in our dark electron sector. So let's now set up this. What we need to do is to study the evolution of the Jeans mass, and let's now do that in a semi-analytic approach. Okay? And the evolution of the Jeans mass is actually easy-ish to understand. And the reason is that the gene's mass depends on density, temperature, and particle model parameters. And the density and temperature, as the dark electron halo collapses, we can keep track of by just doing energy conservation. So we know by energy conservation is that if the halo collapses, all the energy, all the gravitational energy, will go into thermal energy minus any work that is done in the collapse, and minus any cooling that may have happened. And this is when cooling will start being important. For us, the cooling function is extremely simple. We only have one cooling process, it's Bremsstrahlung. You cannot see that very well either. But the Bremsstrahlung cooling rate, the only thing that I want you to realize is that it's larger for larger densities of the dark electron and for larger temperatures. And it plummets when the temperature of your dark electron gas is too small. Because if the temperature is too small, you cannot emit dark photons. Okay? So this equation in this shape is not that useful. We need to understand the evolution of temperature as a function of density. So let's massage it into a more useful way. So this quantity here tells us the evolution of the temperature as a function of density as the halo collapses. There's a piece that comes from work here. And there's a piece here that has all the information about the timescales in the problem. First of all, there's a cooling timescale here. That cooling timescale is just given by the cooling rate that I have here. And secondly, there's a collapse timescale that tells us how the density of this dark electron gas changes as time changes. Okay, so this collapse time will be different for different stages of collapse. So this equation then specifies a contour in the density temperature plane as the galaxy collapses. And now what we're going to do, a very simplified story of galaxy and substructure formation within the galaxy, deep in the nonlinear regime. So we're going to set up this in this way. We have a big ball of dark electron gas. It's the ball of dark electron gas within our galaxy. We impose that it was 1% of our galaxy, or we are going to impose that it's 1% of our galaxy. So if the galaxy has 10 to the 12 solar masses, we have 10 to the 10 solar masses of dark electron gas. And we're going to see how the density and the temperature of this dark electron gas evolves as a function of time. Or we're going to follow a contour here. So here, again, you don't see that very well, but there are contours of the Jeans mass. And they have this funny shape here. And the Jeans mass is in units of solar masses. Okay, so there are two important features in these Jeans mass contours. First of all, the Jeans mass increases as the temperature increases. And that, of course, makes sense. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry for that. Is it possible to see?
Yeah.
Okay. For you, it's great. maybe I can just draw it like very quickly. So we have this plot here, and we have Jeans masses that do this funny shape here. Okay, and this is in units of solar mass. The numbers you see. Okay. So there's a couple of important features in these Jeans mass contours. First, as temperature increases, the Jeans mass increases. That, of course, makes sense because you have more kinetic pressure. But at large densities, the Jeans mass becomes independent of temperature. And that, again, makes a lot of sense because at large densities, the dark electrons are so close together that they feel the repulsive dark photon force. So then the main source of pressure is not kinetic, it's just the dark photon repulsive force. So the Jeans mass then depends on this dark on just the dark photon mass, basically. It doesn't depend on the temperature anymore. Okay? So let's start now studying the evolution of the galaxy in this nonlinear regime. So we pick up with some initial conditions for the temperature and density that actually are unimportant, and I will tell you why they are unimportant in a while. But we pick up with some initial conditions, and initially the dark electron gas, it's cold. It's rather dense, but not that dense. But the important point is that it's cold. And if it's cold, then there's not enough kinetic pressure. So this thing will just free fall to the center. Gravity will just quickly overcome pressure. And this ball will free fall to the center gravitationally. So there will be an initial stage of free fall in which the density and the temperature will increase. Because as the thing collapses, the gravitational energy is turned into thermal energy. And then we will follow some contour towards larger temperatures and larger densities. And the timescale for this process is given by the freefall timescale. It's purely gravitational. Mm-hmm. So that's the first stage of galactic formation. In the second stage, at some point, the temperature becomes so high and the density becomes so high that the pressure becomes high also. So at some point, this ball should be stabilized by kinetic pressure. When does that happen? That happens when this contour here crosses the line of the Jeans mass of 10 to the 10 solar masses. Because the Jeans mass is exactly what sets the threshold for collapse or the absence of collapse. So it's precisely what sets the threshold for virialization. So when we hit this point here, so this is the 10 to the tensor mass contour. You don't see it very well. It's like that. It's like that. When you hit that line, then the collapse of this ball needs to be stopped, and it's stopped by kinetic pressure. That's great. It gets stopped, and then you will say that's the end of the story. But now is when cooling comes into play. So this is the first time that cooling becomes important in all the story. Why does it become important? It becomes important because once you get stabilized by kinetic pressure, you start emitting dark photons slowly. So there's a cooling rate. So what happens is that the ball will collapse a bit more. It will emit photons. It will collapse a bit more, emit more photons, et cetera, et cetera. So there will be a stage of semi-virialized collapse. How will this stage proceed? It will proceed by following the line, the contour line of virialization that is set by the Jeans mass contour of 10 to the tensor masses. Because our galaxy is 10 to the tensor masses, so that's when it virializes. So we will follow now this contour. This process, of course, happens at the cooling timescale now. So the collapse is not anymore the free fall timescale, it's the cooling timescale. Okay.
So this is still optically thin?
Still optically thin. And the optical thickness will become super important in a couple of slides.
Your temperature's getting up.
Yep.
So that's going to produce dark radiation. Back to that question. At some point, you're going to see the dark radiation.
Yeah, it's the cooling you're talking about.
But when?
Yeah.
That's just the radiation. That's dark radiation.
What about the acoustical oscillations?
That was way in the past. So the dark acoustic oscillations, those happen in the linear regime, and those do happen.
The temperature was smaller then.
Yes, but... Right. But that was the primordial plasma, so this is not the... So, yeah, so there can be dark acoustic oscillations in the primordial plasma if the temperature of the primordial plasma is large enough. But remember, this is not the background of dark electrons in the whole universe. It's just one ball of dark electrons now. It's just within the galaxy. Yeah. So, great. So then the collapse will keep happening. But of course, this happens at the cooling timescale. And we have to check then that the cooling timescale is faster than the age of the universe, and that can be quickly checked. And again, you cannot see this. But there's a contour here. I'm going to draw it again. Maybe on the right. Oh, you can see it here? Can you all see it here?
Actually, sorry. It makes the green lines more visible, actually.
Okay, so there's this whole blue region here where the cooling timescale is actually longer than the age of the universe. So in those regions, you wouldn't be able to collapse in a semi-virialized stage. But we're in this white region where the cooling timescale is short enough. So we are fine. The semi-virialized stage of collapse that depends on cooling can actually still happen. Okay? So then we're good. We can just keep moving on to the next stage of collapse, which is the most interesting one.
So for normal, so for just stars, what does that line look like? Is it more, I mean, it doesn't have that same regime and that argument for stars, right?
This is the initial big halo, so it's a whole halo. It still has a semi-virialized stage of collapse. And I will tell you that what actually happens in a few slides from now, because the actual story is a bit more complicated. This is a very simplistic picture that will allow us to get a lot of intuition, but this complete story is a bit more complicated. And I will tell you then, if that doesn't answer your question, hopefully you can ask me again.
I thought there was some argument about the temperature being almost constant during the free fall. Maybe it's just the cooling time is really short for normal gas.
We will come now to lower, to smaller cooling timescale, and we will see what happens. It's a bit different to what you see, but there are different
so
regions.
Is that still optically thin, or is that in the optically thick regime for the stars?
So for stars, those older, it collapses at almost isothermal
Yes, so then I'm also puzzled why that doesn't happen.
So that depends a bit on the cooling time. But now we're going to follow is something that is in between of what you're saying and what we have here. But we will see what will happen. So if you had a constant temperature, isothermal collapse, then what will happen is fragmentation. And I will tell you why that happens now. And so that will become clear now.
So you're about to lose pressure support.
I'm
at the end of that line is when you lose pressure support.
I'm going to that point now. That is the point of fragmentation. So at some point, the cooling timescale becomes short enough. And when the cooling time scale becomes short enough, then the temperature of this big ball of gas plummets, okay? Because you start emitting dark photons crazily, and even if you collapse, then you emit dark photons so fast that you lose pressure support, and this thing just free falls to the center. So now we have a collapse time scale that is just the free fall time scale again, and we start crossing towards regions of smaller Jeans masses. When we cross to regions of smaller Jeans masses, you see that that's precisely fragmentation. Now, smaller blobs between the big blob can start collapsing on their own. First, a blob of 10 to the 8 solar masses, that's that line. A blob of 10 to the 6 solar masses, that's that line. Then 10 to the 4, et cetera, et cetera. 10 to the 2, et cetera, et cetera. So that's precisely fragmentation. It's the evolution of Jeans masses towards lower values. If you had isothermal collapse, you see that you would also have fragmentation. Because if you had isothermal collapse, you would also start crossing towards values of smaller Jeans masses, and you would also have fragmentation. The slope of this thingy here depends on the specifics of the model.
What keeps the star stable for 10 billion years? Because there are no barriers.
Excellent question. I'm going to tell you also that in one or two slides. I'm going to tell you what keeps them stable. So this thing is then fragmenting, and you are going to form smaller and smaller blobs. And at some point, fragmentation stops. And somebody already asked me what was the role of optical thickness. And now is when optical thickness becomes important. And the fragmentation stops because at some point, the densities of this gas become so high that dark photons cannot escape anymore. The object becomes optically thick. And at that point, cooling becomes extremely inefficient because now you can only cool from the surface. So when cooling becomes inefficient, fragmentation stops. So it stops here when we cross the line of optical thickness of our gas. And here we see that the star corresponds to a fragment of 10 to the 2 solar masses. So we see that fragmentation stopped at a mass of a typical protostar of 10 to the 2 solar masses. So the minimal fragment is exactly a protostar, 10 to the 2 solar masses. And at a density that is roughly 10 to the minus 6 times the density of the sun, that is roughly the density of a red giant. So to answer another question that came up, what do I mean by star and how are the stars stable? What I mean by star is just like a really compact ball of dark electron gas that is stabilized by the dark photon repulsive force. So that's the thing that stabilizes. So it's all charged electrons, and there's a dark photon repulsive force, and that stabilizes the whole gas. It's like a dark electromagnetism. It's just like literally electrons with a photon. It just like keeps them apart. So that's what stabilizes the star. And okay, so now we finish our story of the evolution of the galaxy. And this is the same that happens in the standard model. It's very similar. The story in the standard model is very similar. You have a stage of fragmentation, then a minimal fragment that's limited by optical thickness. That's called opacity-limited fragmentation. It was postulated in the end of the 70s, and it's the standard story for the formation of stars. And it's also the standard story for the formation of stars in our dark sector. So they are exotic compact objects. They are not stars in the sense that they do not have fusion. It's just like exotic compact objects. Okay. However, our model has a difference with the standard model in the sense that it has an additional mechanism for the end of fragmentation. And again, you cannot see this. But the additional mechanism for the end of fragmentation is that for different values of the particle physics parameters that you take, you follow a similar contour. And at some point, fragmentation starts. It starts here. But at some point, you hit a point where the dark photon repulsive force becomes dominant. And the Jeans mass is then fixed by these horizontal lines here that you don't see anymore. But they are horizontal lines like here. And when that happens, then as you go towards larger densities, the Jeans mass actually increases, regardless of the temperature, because the Jeans mass is now controlled by the dark photon force. So that means that at that point, fragmentation must stop. And fragmentation stops there then, and then the star slowly cools. And then that is another mechanism for the end of fragmentation, which you are just calling it the dark photon repulsive force limited or something. So we have opacity limited and dark photon repulsive force limited fragmentation. So that's all fun, but now we can start moving around particle physics parameters to actually see what happens with these stars. So this is, I chose here dark electron masses of 10 GeVs, dark photon masses of 100 electron volts. Then the mass that I get for the typical protostar in this dark sector or proto-exotic compact objects is 1.5 times the mass of the sun. This is the sun for reference with the radius scaled for reference. And then what we're going to do now, we're going to increase the dark electron mass, and we will see how the mass of this dark star changes. And as I increase the dark electron mass, we see that the mass of the star, the radius decreases, but the mass of the star increases. And the reason why it increases is that for larger dark electron masses, then cooling becomes less efficient. Then fragmentation becomes less efficient, so you have bigger objects, so you cannot form small fragments. So great, this is all illustrating, and we went over a quite complete story of galaxy formation, but to me, the most interesting plot of all this talk are these plots here. So now we can do the same analysis for across all parameter space. And these are these two plots here. So here I'm plotting the dark electron mass, the dark photon mass. These black lines here are contours of the mass of the exotic compact objects in this dark sector in units of solar mass. So that's one solar mass, 100 solar masses, 10,000 solar masses, et cetera. In blue, we have contours of compactness of these exotic compact objects. So that's 10 to, and where compactness is defined to be 1/2 for a black hole, that's a normalization. So the 10 to the minus 1 here, so that's close to the compactness of a black hole. This is less compact, 10 to the minus 3. 10 to the minus 5 is roughly the compactness of a red giant. It's a bit more than the compactness of a red giant, et cetera. So this is precisely, sorry.
Astrophysical styles are electrically neutral.
Yeah.
Electricity discharges, positive. Very little electricity. So are your dark electrons electrically neutral in this star?
Nope, they are all dark electrons. They are purely dark electrons.
So they're only on one charge.
Well, you always problems because the dark photon is massive, right? So, it's a very unusual world.
You know. So if you tell you can't produce dark photons from annihilation.
There's no annihilation, right?
So the whole thing is looking different from
the time. Yep. So it's a bit simpler, actually. So it's quite a bit simpler, actually. So great. So now what do we see? We see that at large dark electron masses, large dark photon masses, we have small fragments, so solar-sized objects. As I decrease the electron mass or decrease the photon mass, fragmentation becomes less efficient, and we have more massive fragments. So the proto-exotic compact objects in this dark sector are quite massive. And there are a couple of more interesting. There's more interesting information in these slides. Here in this upper left corner, you don't see it, but there's a whole region here when the dark photon masses are too large that the compactness is so high that these objects here are actually black holes. But we will see why that's a bit disfavored in a second. This is the same plot, but for a different value of the fine structure constant. So this is precisely what we were looking for. We were looking for a map between dark, between Lagrangian parameters and big astrophysical properties of big, big objects. So this is the map that we were looking for. So now, in principle, if you could measure these properties of these astrophysical objects, you could trace back to what are the underlying particle physics parameters. Yeah, but remember that this. So, well, first of all, remember that the photon has a mass. Secondly, if the temperature is high enough, then at some point you could produce, like, but it needs to be really high. So in our initial sector, there were electrons and positrons. Remember, the positrons annihilated with the electrons. The temperature was super high, like the order of the electron mass, then you will pre-produce those guys. That's true. But the temperatures of these objects are never that high as a GeV or 10 GeV. That is the thing is that we're taking. So that just doesn't happen.
But to begin with, you are never close to critical field. You need, very concentrated big charges over here.
Distance between particles is fairly sizable. They're very compact. But the dark photon mass is also very high. So, I mean, it's a short range.
Yeah.
That's another trouble. The reason is the ratio of the gravitational force to Coulomb is 10 to the power of 40. So this, it has a small amount of electric charge, it would blow up instantly. Now you have this dark charge that's producing a Coulomb type force. Why
so
does
you
it,
call it type
why
force?
Why does the star blow up?
It's
the photon has a mass.
Force, huh? It's not the Coulomb force, it's a Yukawa force, right? So you can, if you over concentrate within the Yukawa radius, then yes, things will push apart until you have an expansion. It's a different world.
Yep.
It sure is.
What's it sure?
Can I ask, I miss what are the blue level lines? 10 to minus 7 to 10 to minus 1?
This is compactness.
Compactness. Okay.
Yep. So there's an additional piece of information in this whole plot that is really important. And the and that comes to the details, and the table is in the details. There's this dashed red line here. Okay. Above this dashed red line, the formation of all these exotic compact objects is highly disfavored for a reason that I'm going to tell you now. And below this dashed red line, it's favored. Okay. And the reason is that the actual formation of the galaxy is a bit more complicated. It's not that, so what happens actually, so we're going to go back a few slides. We're going to go back to this initial freefall stage. This is not really what happens. Really what happens in the formation of a galaxy is that you do have an initial stage of freefall, but when that happens, quickly a shock forms near the center, at least in a spherical approximation. And the shock expands, and the shock is responsible for the virialization of the galaxy. You can actually calculate that shock temperature analytically, at least in a spherical collapse model. And the temperature of the shock was calculated quite a bit ago, several decades ago. And it's roughly 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, and to the normalized to the typical electron mass that we're going to take, and the typical mass of the electron halo that we're going to take. So that means that in this that this initial stage of freefall that went into the virialized stage actually was a jump from here to a some large temperature. Okay? But if the temperature that we jumped to was smaller than the mass of the photon, then there wouldn't be any cooling to start with, because we can just not emit dark photons. We cannot do not have enough energy to emit those dark photons. Then this semi-virialized stage of collapse will have never happened. Okay? So once you put those details in, you see that only the objects below this line can actually form. And this is important for a thing that will come in a couple of slides. So here you can still maybe form exotic compact objects, but you will need some sort of complicated formation history, which I don't know what it is. Maybe some more complicated collapse with some mergers that increases the temperature of the halo, or I don't know, some gravitational collapse or something, but I don't know. But here we're good in all this plot here, in all this part here.
So in that regime where the cooling is never efficient, then the structure just is like normal cold dark matter? Is that the picture?
It's not really like cold dark matter because this sector is strongly self-interacting. So it's like strong.
Right, okay, but besides that.
Yeah, but besides, yeah.
Okay.
Coming back to this point, you have to assume that the energy density of the sector is like order 1% of dark matter. Otherwise, you cannot decrease enough the coupling constant, you know, not to have problems with the temperature of the dark sector, with the inhalation of the.
Well, I will have problems with the constraints from self-interacting dark matter. If it was 100% of dark matter, the fine structure constant that I have is large-ish.
You cannot decrease it enough because otherwise you would have a lot of dark photons.
And otherwise, I wouldn't have any cooling to start with.
Yeah. Also.
So. Okay, so let me tell you some final remarks that they're all quite important. So we went over all this trouble. We started with the primordial power spectrum, and we went over the whole evolution of this thing, linear, nonlinear, et cetera, et cetera. Why is this all so important? So why didn't you just say that there were some stars going around, some exotic compact objects made of dark electrons? Study the stability of these objects and just get over with it and do something else. Turns out that the formation history is extremely important. So to illustrate this is not to put shame on other people's work, but it's just to illustrate why structure formation is so important. These are two very well-known papers that are in the literature that they actually study this exact same model. So dark electrons with a dark photon mass, etc. These guys here study if you could see these exotic compact objects at LIGO. And they conclude that there's a band of parameter space for the mass of the exotic compact objects and the mass of the dark electrons, in which could in principle be seen by LIGO. Okay? But then you go into the details and you see that the dark photon mass they take is a fraction of a GeV. So it's a really large mass. So let's go back to our plot and let's see where a fraction of a GeV is. It's like up here. It's like really, really high. So that mass is way, way, way above the shock temperature of the halo. So those things just never formed. Those exotic compact objects, there's no at least in standard cosmology, standard story of galaxy formation, those objects never formed. So these things just don't exist. Another example, this is an example of a paper where they studied the stability of the final exotic compact object, and they were trying to solve this core versus cusp problem by saying that this dark sector could have some large stealth interactions. Again, they take the dark photon mass to be 10 MeVs. We go again back to our plot, 10 MeVs is like up here. Again, those objects never formed, the shock temperature was never high enough, and if you decrease this value, then these guys cannot solve the core versus cusp problem. So it is important to study the whole story of structure formation. And the reason is that usually studying only the stability of the final exotic compact object leads to unrealistic setups. And moreover, the requirements for the echoes to be stable are not necessarily, do not necessarily cover the requirements for these echoes to form in the first place. So that's the first remark that I want to make. Secondly, we did all these semi-analytic estimates, and we got a lot of information from this dark sector. We calculated the minimal mass of the exotic compact objects due to fermentation. In principle, you can also calculate the maximal mass. So that will be done by including accretion. So that we didn't do, but in principle, you can do that. You can calculate the compactness. That's quite easy. You can estimate the abundance, because if, for instance, we have fragments that are one solar mass, and we have 10 to the 10 solar masses in our dark electron galaxy, then we have 10 to the 10 of these objects. So that's roughly one dark electron star every 10 normal stars. So that's a lot of dark electron stars. But there are things that we cannot calculate. So for instance, we cannot calculate the initial mass function because we can calculate the minimal size of the fragment, the maximal one, but we do not really know how they are statistically distributed in that range, at least with our semi-analytic simplified analysis. Secondly, we cannot calculate the shape of the dark electron galaxy. That's really important. And the reason is that we don't know if the galaxy is spheroidal, if it's a disk or whatever. And that's a really complicated calculation. So people have claimed that, for instance, dissipative dark sector dark matter can form double disks, but that's also controversial because there are also papers that they say that the mergers can disrupt the disk. So we don't really know if this disk formed or not. So that things you can actually only see through a heavy numerical simulation that we actually are going to start to do eventually with some people from MIT. Great. So this I'm going to. How much time do I have? 5 minutes? Okay, I'm going to, yeah. So this is about radiation pressure, so I can talk about that if somebody wants offline. But let me go to this is a bit more important. So finally, we have all these exotic compact objects, and what can we learn from them? So how can we see them? So the phenomenology of these exotic compact objects is very simple to the one of, is very similar to the one of primordial black holes. So first of all, of course, we can see these objects in microlensing experiments. There are signatures coming from dynamical heating of stellar clusters, so these compact objects just like interact gravitationally with stars. They puff up stellar clusters and they disrupt them. There's dynamical friction constraints. So these exotic compact objects go around the center of a galaxy. They fall in the center of the galaxy, but there's a limit on how much mass is there in the center of the galaxy. So there are constraints from that. And then what's interesting is that there are a lot of new ideas coming out in the last couple of years on how to detect exotic compact objects. For instance, people have thought about using pulsar timing array to detect exotic compact objects. Here, the idea is that you have one of these compact objects, you have a neutron star, emits a radio wave that comes to us. These compact objects lenses the frequency of these neutron star radio signals, and that those things we can see, and then sets constraints on these exotic compact objects. There's something called astrometric lensing, which you do lensing of the velocity distribution of stars. That's people from NYU that are doing some excellent work. Then there's the idea to do a strong lensing in the time domain. So that's lensing of fast radio bursts. This is an idea by Julian Munoz and Kaminkowski at Johns Hopkins and other people. The idea there is that there are some fast radio bursts that they come from far, and you have an exotic compact object in the middle. The signal follows two paths, but the two paths have a different, they have a different path, so they arrive to us with a slight difference in time, and that's a strong lensing in the time domain. So those things can set very strong constraints on exotic compact objects. People have said that you can look for these things as binaries in gravitational wave detectors, but that's more model dependent because it's really hard to see which ones of these guys form binaries, et cetera. There's even people that say that you could do gravitational wave lensing. So that's a bit more exotic. Two more signatures that have been that we discussed a bit in our paper is that dark electrons are forming compact objects and compact structures. So there's an interesting question: is there any correlation in the formation of compact objects in the dark electron sector and in the baryonic sector? So, for instance, are the overdensities in the same place? Are they in different places? Can dark electrons accrete into baryonic structure, or baryonic structure accrete into dark electron structure? If that's the case, then we could look like at astronomical objects that we already know, like the Sun, and try to see if there's some of this dark matter accumulating in the Sun. People have done that in the past. In addition, if you allow for a mixing between the dark photon of this sector and our dark photon, that mixing should be small, then these stars will look as dim stars. So that we also said in our paper, there are people working on that. So that's another signature that could be interesting, but that actually requires interactions with the standard model. So to conclude, we describe the complete history of structure formation in at least the simplest dissipative dark sector model that I could come up with. And we're quite comprehensive. We started with the primordial power spectrum. We went over the complete story. We realized how we can actually see properties of particle dark matter in big astronomical objects. And we provided a map. And that's important. We didn't do like just one benchmark point. We actually provided a map between objects on the sky and Lagrangian parameters of at least a simplified theory. Now there's a wide range of opportunities that lays ahead. First, you could turn this thing into an industry. So you can now start trying to analyze more complicated models, as was suggested in the beginning, like mirror dark matter, atomic dark matter, and provide similar maps. So organize and see what are the typical astronomical objects of these models as I vary around my model parameters, and study the structure formation history of these models. Secondly, we need to think about new astronomical signatures for these models. And finally, we need to think about numerical simulations for these things, because like these semi-analytic estimates give you lots of intuition, but they may be wrong in different ways. So there are many approximations that we took. Many things can go wrong. So we need to do numerical simulations, and we're starting to do that with Mark at MIT and with some people from Stony Brook. So the message that I want to convey, the take-home message, is that even if dark matter doesn't have any non-gravitational interactions with the standard model, we can still learn a lot about the particle nature of dark matter. So that's it. Thanks for this talk.
This means we've been attempting for 30, 35 years to detect WIMPs and axioms. As far as I can tell, without success. So now we have to worry about detecting dark electrons, dark photons. Now, there have been experiments done to detect dark photons through axion conversion. They haven't been successful. The last comment is that two galaxies have been observed, published and documented. No dark matter, very little. Others supposedly on the way. Now we have galaxies only made of dark matter. So, well, we can draw conclusions.
So, I don't know what was the question.
Let me ask another different question. So, do you have a knot that tells you whether these things start to collapse before the dark matter starts? Or are these things falling into wells that are better evaporated?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And the nonlinearities arise roughly at the same time in baryons in this dark electron sector and also in dark matter, because it's just controlled by gravitation. So the turnaround redshift, when things like decouple from the Hubble flow, that's just controlled by gravitation. So that doesn't really care about if you have baryons, dark electrons, or dark matter.
So it's all adiabatic, so they're all just coexisting?
Yeah. In other words, how can you calculate when things turn around and just become self-gravitating objects and go nonlinear? You take the power spectrum and you evolve it. And the power spectrum is the same for baryons and cold dark matter, right? They need the initial one. It's like
you start off with the same, you use the same thing.
Yeah. So that in that sense is very minimal. So that's what I said in the very, very beginning, that in nature there's a preferred way to form structure, because we know that all the ingredients are already there in one preferred way, which is the way that forming structure by dissipation. All the elements are already there. The only thing that we need is dark matter to have some dissipation. That's it.
So at the end, you said you're worried about baryons. And I think you said you're worried about these things getting accreted into baryonic optics.
for instance, that could happen.
How do you stop the baryons from getting accreted in this, or if they're starting all together, would they all just collapse at the same time and I'd have this dark matter halo, this, and have all these, you know, I'd have a big lump of baryons, self-interacting dark matter?
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. And let me tell you that I do not know the answer, but I have thought about it. And the reason why I don't know the answer is that initially I thought these things are just going to grow in a correlated way, in the same places, so they will just fall into the same places. But then somebody pointed out to me that baryons and dark matter, for instance, they don't really form structure in the same place. And the reason is that baryons have acoustic oscillations, so they move a lot. So at some point, the places where you have dark matter over densities and baryon over densities, they decorrelate. This could be the same in this dark sector. So dark electrons have also dark acoustic oscillations, but they decouple earlier than the, or later. They could decouple earlier or later than the baryon acoustic oscillations. So in principle, there could be some velocity difference between these guys, and then they will form structure in different places. But there could be also a regions of parameter space in which they form structure in the same places. And then one will need to worry about, like, precisely correlated formation of structure. How will that modify our picture? It will decrease the Jeans mass, because now the dark electrons will fall into a deeper gravitational potential. So fragmentation will be preferred, actually, will be more preferred. So we'll probably form more compact objects.
So these dark stars don't like baryons.
They really don't like
baryons.
Here. these dark stars are in this galaxy if they exist, right? So they are just going around, and we just haven't seen them because they are dark.
The galaxy seems much don't
like dark matter. Where did the dark matter go? This is the fundamental question that's starting to develop. So, cold dark matter does its own thing. It forms an NFW halo. Baryons do their own thing. They form their disk and their stars. And these guys, or dark electrons, they do their own thing also. They form their own exotic compact objects within the galaxy. So it's just a third component. You could ask the same question about baryons and dark matter, right? Baryons did their stuff. And cold dark matter, sorry.
Are there other questions? No? Then let's thank Daniel again.